Unemployment is really hard work. When I became unemployed, I was confused because the usual stories around persistence and effort and things just working out didn't match my experience at all. Unemployed people are stereotyped as ne'er-do-wells, layabouts, good-for-nothings, or bludgers, but is that true? In this series, I'll be chatting with 5 unemployed and underemployed people about how they got there, what their lives look like day to day, and why the usual stereotypes don't explain much. So you're on 3CR Radical Radio, listening to The Lives of the Unemployed, a show about what it's like to be unemployed. Today I'll be chatting with Caitlin Blythe, she, her, legend, rock star, unemployed, on a disability pension, producer and presenter on Breadline. Welcome to 3CR, Caitlin.
Oh my God, what a great introduction. Thank you. Completely unprompted. Thank you so much.
So let's start at the beginning. When you were growing up, did you grow up with the impression that there was a normal path that people were meant to follow?
I think I grew up under the impression that I had a lot of potential that I needed to realize, and that it was more about me, like what I was expected of me, and not so much what was normal for all people. My parents both had university degrees, but I don't think that everyone above them in the family tree did. So I think they really saw that I was good at school and they wanted me to follow that as far as I could. But you know, my younger brother was an academic and I don't feel like there was any pressure. He could tell me, maybe he'd tell it different, but I don't feel like there was pressure on him to be like, well, you've got to go to uni. I should say, just with my accent, my parents emigrated from America to Australia not long before I was born, so I have their accent somehow.
English accent because my parents are English, so I tell you.
Yay! That's so nice because most people go, "Oh, that's weird," because I moved here as a child and I picked up the Australian accent, and I'm like, I don't know why I sound this way. But people think that I'm like a recent immigrant, and I'm like, no shade on immigrants. I'm not. I'm not an American coming to steal your jobs. I'm an American Australian coming to steal your welfare.
Yeah, there's only so much that we can do about our bodies, hey?
That's true, boy, that's true.
So when you were young, what did you imagine your career would look like with all of this like external pressure?
I was going to be a stand-up comedian and I was going to be really famous. I wanted to be a poet and an author. And my parents, I think I had a really strong sense of self, and I guess my parents just had to, I don't know how to say, like, try and not get in my way or try to get out of my way. Cause I wasn't like a mean kid. I just really knew that I loved books. I just really loved words and I really wanted to, I just knew what I was going to do with my life, you know, which I feel like really lucky about. Not a lot of people get that, and get to do it. So, but yeah, there was definitely a real strong pressure on me. You know, I was in the gifted and talented programs. I was given all the extracurriculars. I was expected to do great things, basically. But I wouldn't say, I think the normal path was expected. There's a real like American Protestant work ethic of like, don't take welfare. Don't be a burden on the state. Don't be a burden on anyone. And pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I did kind of grow up with that a little bit. But I also think that my parents had moved to Australia because they wanted a different life than what they grew up with. So they didn't, I think they were actually pushing against what they grew up with, which was much more harsh. Yeah, I've been unpacking a lot of stuff since like leaving high school, I think, or even during high school. Because I think I became chronically ill at 16. So I knew that like, hard work wasn't going to be possible for me. Like it wasn't going to be possible for me to just grind and get money. So I had to find a different sense of self. Like I had to find self-worth in another way, which I'm still working on. Lifelong project.
So what was your first real job? Did you go to stand-up comedy straight away?
Oh, it took me ages to try stand-up comedy because I was so afraid I'd be bad at it. Because you know when you love something so much and you've always dreamed of it, you don't want to fail at it because then the dream is broken. But I did start doing performance poetry, and I tried to be an actor for a while. There's not a lot of acting opportunities in Perth, but I went for auditions. I don't know if you've ever heard the like Ship to Shore and those kind of shows. They filmed in Perth. It's okay if you're too young. yeah, I was going to be an actor, realized I wasn't that good at acting. So I did performance poetry, poetry slams. But my first job, I mean, other than babysitting, I got a job at as a waitress at Sizzler. So yeah, I waited tables and then I did hospo for 3 or 4 years until I became too ill to keep doing that.
Just as an aside, was it one of those Sizzlers that had the fake volcano?
No. Oh my God. Fake volcano. We missed out.
Well, the one that was closest to me had a fake volcano and all these fake tropical plants. So it was sort of like, it was like an island theme.
What?
What was yours like?
That's so, it was just a normal Sizzler. That's so disappointing. Because Sizzler itself is kind of, I mean, I don't think we have them here anymore, but it's kind of a weird experience anyway, because you have the buffet thing and like as a kid you just get to like run around and get whatever food you want. But yeah, Sizzler was where I learned how to be a cog in the capitalist machine.
Yeah, hospitality is one of those places where I think you first maybe learn that emotional performativity of customer service.
Oh yeah, when I learned the phrase, oh what is it? Like emotional labor, I was like, yeah, you totally do that as a waitress, as a wait staff person, as a server. I had to, and I did this, I later went into retail, and I had to do this with so many, mostly like, it was just mostly like men, but everyone, but you had to just manage so many big feelings. And I had a man, like keep in mind, I was like 17, 18, 19. I had a man threaten to throw his steak at me because it wasn't done the way he liked. And the Sizzler steaks come in like sizzling, a sizzling hot plate, which actually like I used to always have burns up and down my forearms from carrying those big hot plates. Yeah, he was like, I mean, I'm not the one who cooked it, of course, but I'm the one he's going to yell at because if he yelled at Narelle in the kitchen, she would clock him. But he knows that if he yells at the skinny, scared teenager girl that's like wearing an apron, that I'm just going to like try and placate him and burst into tears in the back. And there were women working there in that job who were in their 60s who'd been doing it as like full time. That was their career. And they were amazing. Like I just wanted to be as good as them at it, but I didn't have the physicality. Like they could carry like so many plates of food and those strong arms. And I always thought I would get stronger eventually. And but because I'm disabled, I just didn't. I was lucky enough to not have to work during high school. A lot of my friends had after school jobs, and I think I probably would have too, but I did become chronically ill. And I also was really working hard at my studies, and I was really on the university track, I think. And my parents had enough money where I didn't have to help out with bills or anything. So, yeah, I think there was I felt like, you know, I came in and I was really green, and managers who've felt like adults to me, but looking back, they were probably like 25. They were just emotionally devastating me on a daily basis. It was tough, but I learned how to like just be organized, kind of be an adult.
Do you feel like this experience at Sizzler with men yelling at you with burns on your arms, do you think it shaped your attitude towards work?
It made me want to be tougher. Yeah. And I think it probably toughened me up a bit in a way that's maybe not the best because I wanted to survive in this environment. And I kind of had, and this was the 2000, the early 2000s. It was in Perth, Western Australia. It's a very masculine environment. It's very, there's no softness allowed. There's no, like femininity is really looked down on. And queerness was really mocked. And any kind of difference really. It was very homo, the culture was very homogenous. And obviously, like, neurodivergence wasn't understood at that point. And it was just a very difficult environment. I was a weird kid, still am. And I really wanted to fit in. Yeah. So I think I blunted myself to try and fit in. But I mean, that's what you had to do. I mean, I moved out, I got the job, and then I pretty quickly moved out of home. I needed to escape my home life, so I moved into a really shitty share house full of other Sizzler employees. We all worked at the same branch. And I needed that money to pay rent, pay for food, keep my car, keep petrol in my car. So yeah, just, did what I had to do. Maybe back to your question about like the normal path for people in work. I definitely did not think that, and this is something I'm just realizing now, I didn't see the arts as a path forward. Like I didn't, like my parents had no real concept of like the creative industries. We didn't even have that term back then as being like a feasible life. Like you couldn't really pay for anything if you were in the arts. So it was more like, oh, you can do this as your hobby. That's cute. But like you got to be able to like put on a tie on an apron and walk the floors of Sizzler to make rent and stuff. So
So you had this passion, you had this vocation, like you knew what you wanted to do with your life.
vocation, yeah, exactly. That's the perfect word.
That it wouldn't be a viable career, that you'd have to have some other full-time job and do your passion in your spare time.
Yeah, which if you're chronically ill is basically impossible because, I was just working and I was only working like casual. So, but I would work just enough shifts, and I wasn't the best. I was not good at waiting tables because of a few things. I think looking back now, I understand my neurodivergence better and I can see where I was, why I was struggling. Also, I know that I wasn't physically capable, which I actually left HOSPO because my supervisor at a not at Sizzler, at a later restaurant, that I really loved that job, but she sat me down and she said, "You just can't keep up with the other wait staff." And I was like, "I know." And my health was really failing at that point. Unfortunately, it's just like if you're too sick to keep up, they don't try and accommodate you because they can just replace you easily. You're 19, they're just going to replace you. They haven't invested that much in you. Like, just find another teenager. And then I sort of left the workforce. I've never really fully left the workforce. It's weird to think of myself as unemployed, even though I know I am. I'm more like underemployed. But these days, it's like you can just say you're freelance. But it's like, when was the last time you got an invoice paid? It's like, ooh, a while ago. I think I'm just unemployed. And the bedroom philosopher, this comedian, I can't remember his government name at the moment, but he wrote a book called Fun Employed. And I think that's the term a lot of people in the creative industries, especially in Australia, it's a book about Australia, really. Yeah, like you're fun employed, where it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing where it's like, I think people see it as you're just having fun, but you're also basically unemployed. So you're struggling constantly.
Let's take a little break from a song and then get into the rest of your working life.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Back to you, so we'll trap like criminals.
And that was Northeast Party House with Youth Allowance. You're listening to 3CR Radical Radio and a short summer series called Lives of the Unemployed, in which I talk to people who have been unemployed for a long time about their life history, what led them to this situation, and what life is actually like for people who haven't had a job for a while. Today, I'm talking with Caitlin Blythe, who you'll know from the show Breadline here on 3CR.
I kept waitressing through uni. I went to uni and got my Bachelor of Arts degree with a major in communications. And right when I was, I think in my last semester or second last semester, the global financial crisis happened, which ages me. Basically, I was doing my arts practicum. I was doing work experience at West Australian Publishers, which is the West Australian newspaper, one of the two newspapers in WA. And they came in and they were like, they were telling me how good I was, how you know, overqualified I was for this job. All the copy I wrote was clean and I was efficient and I was smart and passionate. And then people were being laid off in front of me. Like they were the managers were coming in and offering people severance packages before they got fired. And there were just no jobs. So I emerged into a job market where there were just no jobs. And I also, my health then went off a cliff for unrelated reasons. I had got a full-time job at a, as an office administrator, just to pay the bills. I only managed that for 3 months before I nosedived, and I had to quit, which sucked. And I really liked it there, but like also it was my only experience working full-time. I've only ever really worked full-time in a full-time job that most people think of as a normal job for 3 months. And it did, even though the people there were great and I was happy to have the job, I was very, very lucky to have the job. It was killing me. I was miserable. I think I also had really bad depression, which wasn't helping. Yeah. And then I became became too disabled to work during that period. And then since then, I've basically been, you know, mostly unemployed.
So let's get into the present day. What does a fairly typical weekday look like for you now?
Health appointments. I have to rest most of the time. Mm-hmm. I have myalgic encephalomyelitis and a bunch of other conditions. I'm on bed rest. Like if I'm lucky, I'll get to leave the house for maybe like 30 minutes or 60 minutes a day, try and get that sunshine. I'm usually, I can't walk very far, so I don't really go anywhere. I just try to get through every day without ideating too much. And I'm not even depressed. It's just a very depressing situation. I'm actually doing pretty well mentally at the moment. I'm not trying to sound like it's just a hard situation. And I think a lot of people, you know, it was frustrating to have a lot of people in the beginning of the COVID lockdowns be like, this is the worst. And I'm like, you have been acting like I was going through something really easy for years, but you can't even handle like a few weeks of even close to my life. So it's just, I think everyone understands now that being stuck in your home is not fun, not good for your mental health. And I try to work on my projects, but I think I could get like maybe 5 to 10 hours done a week on a good week.
What assumptions did you think that people made about you as an unemployed person before?
Oh, just that I was relaxing, just that it's holiday, I guess, basically. I think they were like in their minds comparing it to when they're on holiday, but they're on holiday like with money, like because they have jobs and it's a break. And there's things that I miss about being employed so much. Like I just miss seeing people. I miss feeling that sense of purpose. I miss having some, like, because I'm now a freelancer, I do sometimes just miss someone else telling me what to do for a while and just knowing what my job is, especially for jobs like waitressing or retail, where I wasn't having to try and push a boulder up the hill creatively. And a manager would tell me what time to show up, where to stand. Mm-hmm. And I do kind of miss that sometimes, although because I only have really limited energy, I wouldn't really want to spend it doing someone else's. I really wouldn't want to spend it, like, my limited energy creating profit for someone else's company, like, to be quite honest. Like, the capital machine is depressing, but I do miss that feeling of, like, getting home, tired, get your pay slip, meet your friends at work, you got your work friends, you got your regulars that come in, you've got somewhere to go today. I do miss that, yeah.
If someone were about to become unemployed, what would you like them to know?
I'd like them to know that you can find a sense of self-worth outside of your productivity, but it's not easy. So anyone who makes you feel guilty for being depressed, just don't listen to them, like, because it's hard. A lot of people are taking for granted their ability to work. A lot of people have this grind set or magical thinking that if you have the right thoughts, then you'll manifest a good life. It's not true. You can have all the right thoughts. You can have all the confidence. You can have all the education, and the system can just fail you. Like, the world is not easy. Yeah, I don't think it's a you problem, really. And also, you know, maybe look into, this is just my disability activist coming out, but I'm like, maybe look into if you're chronically ill or neurodivergent. You might have something that you didn't know was making it extra difficult for you to work. It's okay to take care of yourself, and just really try to save money. Try to save money. I really had to learn how to squirrel away tinned food and cut my own hair and just know that I wasn't going to be able to live, like, up to an aesthetic that full-time employed people can live up to, you know. So sometimes full-time employed people will talk about, like, dressing for the season and stuff, and I'm like, I dress until the clothes wear out. Like, what are you talking about? Oh, you're repeating outfits. Yeah. Yeah, I am. Maybe it's better to find people who don't make you feel small while you're going through this. But also, you just have to learn how to, you have to really find internal self-worth to get through it. And it's not easy. I just don't want anyone to think that they're struggling because they're a failure. It's objectively hard. Anyone would struggle.
And that was a short chat that I had with Caitlin Blythe of 3CR Radio's Breadline program about her lived experience of unemployment. Coming up next is The Black Block, and I'll leave you with a song. This is Working for Centrelink by Errol G.
I lost me job when me boss went broke. First time in 30 years I'd been out of work. I thought I'd apply for unemployment benefits, so off I went down to Centrelink. I stood in a line that stretched out the front door. When I finally got to the counter, I asked for a form. They said I should have rung up or used the internet, cause that's the way they do things now at Centrelink. Slightly disgruntled, I went home and made the call. When I finally spoke to a human, it was 4:30. I was hot and dry and I needed a drink. I'd put in a hard day's work at Centrelink. They asked all sorts of questions about who did what with who. So wonder they didn't want to know the last time I had a poo. They gave me a long list of documents to bring. Tomorrow when I went back to Centrelink. Now being unemployed is bloody hard work. I've been busier than a bookmaker's clerk. Paperwork and interviews take 40 hours a week. You'd think that I was working at Centrelink. I had to prove who I was at least 100 times. Passport and library card and unpaid parking fines. You should have known who I was, at least that's what you think. I was interviewed by me brother-in-law, he works at Centrelink. And then I had to see someone called a job provider, but he was on stress leave, so I talked to his offsider. But old mate didn't have a clue, he was thick as two short planks. Seemed anyone can get a job working at Centrelink. said I needed retraining, and he sent me on my way to a seminar that taught me how to write a resume. I did a few courses and got a ticket in OH&S. Now I'm fully qualified to work at Centrelink. Well, being unemployed is bloody hard work. I've been busier than a bookmaker's clerk. Paperwork and interviews take 40 hours a week. You'd think that I was working for Centrelink. Now I know public servants who don't work as hard as me. They get holidays and super and 50 grand a year. Now it's time for this injustice to end. I'm asking for a pay rise from Centrelink. That little Johnny Howard, he's a clever little bloke. Without us even knowing, he's got us working for the dole. He's bodgied up the figures, he didn't even blink. 'Cause we've got full employment, we're all working for Centrelink. Yeah, being unemployed is bloody hard work. I've been busier than a bookmaker's clerk. Paperwork and interviews take 40 hours a week. You'd think that I was working for Centrelink. I'm working me ass off here at Centrelink.